Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
A lot of people today look like they have it all together. They're successful, they're functioning, they're showing up, but inside they're overwhelmed, overthinking, exhausted. So the question is, why do you feel this way, even when your life looks fine? Today I'm joined by Dr. Jenny Martin. Jenny is a licensed clinical psychologist and a former founder of Gemstone Wellness, where she helps people go deeper than the surface level of just coping and actually understanding what's driving their anxiety. Because today we're not just talking about managing anxiety. We're going deeper than that. We're talking about why we're having it in the first place. Jenny, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so excited to have you here. Tell us a little about yourself. And after that, I just want to get really into this because this is such an important topic that so many people are suffering from.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here too. And, you know, I was the sensitive kid growing up, just sort of the weirdo on the outskirts. And I think I felt really ostracized just for feeling too much. And that really turned into me being curious about how to fit in, trying to sort of become more like everybody else. And there were a few things kind of like that defined my life that really led me to this path of becoming a clinical psychologist that I'll weave through this. But a couple of them I want to touch on now to begin. The first thing that really kind of started the foundation of my path was my acceptance to Interlochen Arts Academy. So that's where I went to high school. And unfortunately, that's become well known lately because of it was a favorite of Jeffrey Epstein's. But before this became newsworthy, it was known for its just incredible art education. So right. I was there studying flute performance, and it was an incredibly competitive environment. And so being there in this really, really highly intense competitive environment wreaked havoc on my nervous system in a way I couldn't put words to it, because I was so sensitive to critique and feedback and things. And being in this very intense competitive environment was really hard. But I also loved the environment, and I was surrounded by people, you know, children, but these developing people from all over the world. And I started noticing how stress and anxiety formed in all of these different ways, culturally and, you know, interpersonally. Some were very outwardly focused and were very inwardly, and it got me really curious. Right. So that was one of the most formative pieces of kind of how I started this path. Fast forward now to college. I did not take a traditional path in studying psychology. I did songwriting in college at Berklee College of Music. After 2 years at the University of Michigan, I transferred to Berklee. It was a big jump. And that is where I lost one of my dearest friends to suicide. And this was one of the friends that I had met at Interlochen, a true musical genius. And that loss really propelled me into trying to understand the connection between just creativity, sensitivity, empathy, the depth of emotion, and mental illness. It was very hard for me to go through that and not understand how someone so beautiful and bright could fall victim to such an illness. I had a really hard time understanding that. Fast forward again, I decided to pursue my doctorate in clinical psychology. So that's how I got there. Still kind of thinking internally of myself as this overly sensitive person. I hadn't yet understood that sensitivity is actually a superpower.
It really is. You know, most people think anxiety is something that they need to fix or control, but you say that it's actually a nervous system response. What does that mean, like, in simple terms?
Okay, so that's a great question. And I want to explain some context before giving the short answer here. So I think we have to look at what's happening societally. So we've become very afraid. We've become afraid of being afraid. We're scared of being scared. We push away from being nervous. Look at the pharmaceutical industry. Look how much we put into trying to mitigate discomfort.
Yes.
Look at media, how much we put into escapism vacations to get away from the nerves of the everyday. Look at all of, you know, the money we pour into short-term fixes to get us out of our own heads because it's so difficult to tolerate our own brains.
Yes.
There is a lot of discomfort with the realities of everyday life that we try to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
what do we do with that? We fall into avoidant patterns. We fall into distancing behaviors, and we lose the connection between listening to what our body is trying to tell us.
Yes, that is so true. That is so true. I think one thing people don't do, well, I can't say all people, but a lot of people, they don't listen to their bodies. They, you know, it's our bodies are always talking to us. And I say that all the time to people, you know, our bodies are always giving us signals. And, you know, we need to listen to those signals because, you know, I always say we think with our heart and then it goes to our brain and then our brain says that it goes back down and it tells us, you know, there's a reason why we get nervous. There's a reason why certain things affect us the way we do. There's, you know, just like inflammation. If we have inflammation, it's because there's something going on in that part of your body. The same thing happens with, you know, when it comes to emotional issues too. Know, the response, it's a response mechanism, but it's trying to figure out why, you know, you're having that, you know, response and what can you do to get rid of that response, you know, that emotional response. You know, exactly. I was wondering, like, why is anxiety not a personal failure? Because I also find too, is that many people find that anxiety is a personal failure in their head, but it really isn't.
Oh my gosh. Love this question. So one of the main reasons is that, okay, some of this is biological. We are meant to be very aware of and very alert for danger, right? So we are biologically predisposed to be on alert for danger, but we are no longer being chased by lions that we need to be on alert for. So we are kind of misfiring internally when we perceive a work deadline erroneously as a lion. So that is happening for us internally, where we have to sort of retrain ourselves to adjust that as, okay, my body doesn't have to perceive that as a lion. We can adjust that cortisol level. We can adjust that stress to be more actual trigger. But there's another element to this that I think is really lost. And that is the intentional piece of disempowerment. So when we look at feelings in general, but anxiety in particular, some of this is systemic and intentional, linked to racism, sexism, and all forms of oppression.
Yes.
That we could talk about ad nauseum. We don't have time for all of it, but just some examples. You think of, you know, all of the stigma that has been around speaking up around feelings. You think of, if you're not in touch with what you're feeling, you're disempowered.
Yes.
If you are aware of how you feel, you can't take action.
Yes.
If you are scared, you will follow. If you are worried, you can be influenced.
Exactly.
And if you stay in a state of arousal and fear and worry, then you remain disempowered and you remain controllable.
Yes. That is so true.
So lots of groups and systems benefit from other groups remaining disempowered. This is why it is my passion to remind people that anxiety, feelings are intelligence.
Yes.
Coming through.
And that is so true. And a lot of people don't view it like that. And it's so true. You hit it on the ball. You know, this is something that I see a lot too, is that people who look successful on the outside feel stuck inside.
Yeah.
Why do you think high functioning people often are the ones struggling the most?
I think there's a social conditioning. You know, it's hard for me even to use the term high functioning. I struggle with that, I think, because once you've been identified either for other as in that camp of high functioning, there is a social reinforcement of being seen as quote good that is really hard to lose. So then to show a weakness is to lose that social currency.
Right.
So it becomes very difficult to lose that. You've achieved something, you're seen as something that holds a level of social currency that is hard to give up. So to show anything that is perceived as not high functioning, you know, that language, what are we labeling as high functioning?
Exactly.
Checking off everything on your to-do list, making no errors in the kids' schedule, measuring as high functioning. So I like to try to re-narrate that as, what's the ruler of high functioning? And could we create a different way of measuring that? To where it's just about being in touch with what you need in any given day. And did you listen to that? And could that be the measure of I functioned for myself or not?
Right. And I think what people miss too is that everybody is capable of doing to different levels. And so what is, you know, high performance for one individual is not for another. For, you know, someone, you know, some people have different goals, different expectations. They have, you know, they want to reach their full potential. Many people's full potential, everyone has a different, you know, definition of that. So, you know, using the word high function and is kind of, it is like, it's a word that really shouldn't be really used, because high functioning is different for every individual, I think.
Right, right. It's completely relative. And that's where I started realizing for myself personally, this thing I had carried throughout my whole life, because I think this is a great example for me. I was the perfect example of high functioning, perfect student, you know, got into very prestigious art school, University of Michigan and Berklee College of Music. And, you know, but inside, oh my goodness, just so nervous. How do I talk to this person? What is this? And will I be good at the next thing? And what is this person thinking? And just a nervous wreck inside.
Right.
Always fearful. I never felt like I was high functioning, because my internal script was, well, everyone says I'm really sensitive and I don't feel like I fit in. I hadn't yet understood this whole idea of no. My sensitivity is what makes me powerful. Like, it's actually my power. I hadn't yet harnessed that.
Now, why does their anxiety get missed for these quote unquote high functioning people?
It's hard to see. You know, we have these markers that we look for, even in the DSM, that we've categorized as this is what anxiety looks like. You know, and that's true. Yes, it can look like sweaty palms and shaky hands and difficulty sleeping and all of these things, but a lot of it is internal and a lot of it is not able to be seen. A lot of it is in the quiet moments and it can be covered up, and it's very hard to know. Also, typically, again, the high functioning person is one who has simply learned how to mask it enough to survive in the world to appear a certain way. They've learned the game of camouflage.
Excellent answer. Now, a lot of people listening have tried everything, breathing techniques, journaling, positive thinking. Why do you think quick fixes, you know, don't work long term?
I think for the same, you know, the same reason for anything, any quick fix doesn't work. It just doesn't touch the root. It doesn't touch the root of anything. It can feel good for a moment, but then the root isn't solved. It's still there.
Mm-hmm. I agree. A lot of times we do miss the root cause. And a lot of times I feel, you know, my own opinion, I feel like it always goes back to our childhood years or something traumatic along our timeline that has happened that gets, you know, missed along the way. You know, what do you think a lot of these people are missing, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, saying, oh, journal, do this, do that, you know, what are they missing? You know, that's a component that's so important.
And I would like to add to your really astute insight that often there is something really significant from the past that's coming up with anxiety. Something I'm seeing a lot in my therapy room now is simply just living in the state of the current world is just perpetual unrest that isn't linked to a specific event, that is just pervasive, eco instability, political instability, uncertainty. It's creating this undercurrent of fear. And that's been a really interesting phenomenon I've been seeing lately. So it's rising. And I have a few ideas and things I've been using in my therapy lately that have been helping people. The first thing is to try to track patterns. So whenever anxiety, for example, does rise up, it is doing so for a reason. There's always a reason. If it's okay, I'd love to give an example from a case I'm working on in therapy right now to illustrate this. I'm working with a woman right now who is just lovely. And she and I had a session a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me, judging herself so much, Jenny, I got this text last week, and it was a group text to about 20 people. Mm-hmm. And it just said, hey, I'm trying to organize a group to go to a baseball game this summer. Let me know if you're interested. And I was so nervous and mad and anxious, and my body just started sweating, and I just was so angry. Why was I like that? I'm so weird. And she was judging herself and so angry for this reaction. I just so mad, and she couldn't get out of her own way. And I said, okay, just one second. You can judge yourself as much as you want, as much as you want. But first, can we just pretend? Let's just pretend that whatever that feeling was is trying to tell you something. Like, what would, you know, what is it trying to do? It took a minute. It took a minute to get there. But eventually she was able to say, it's trying to protect me from something. And that was it. A little deep. Eventually she got to, I'm scared I'll go when I really don't want to. So we were able to get to, she has a whole history of letting her boundaries go to make other people happy. And she really wants to hold this boundary and isn't sure she's going to be able to. So we were able then to work on holding the boundary. So in that case, you know, the anxiety was telling her, I'm here. I'm trying to protect you. Just listen to me. This response, don't judge me. I'm just trying to tell you there's a boundary needed. So back to the tool, it's about tracking patterns. Where do you notice the anxiety surging? We tend to judge it before we even look at it. We tend to get in our, gosh, why am I thinking that way again? So we don't even get the information. So put a note in your phone. Just track it. You know, it's going to happen anyway. So just track it. Huh. Every time I'm at this location, I notice this. Or every time, this time of day, I notice this. If there's a pattern, there's something it's trying to tell you. So that's the first. I have a couple more. Do you want to hear them?
I do want to hear them.
This is my favorite one. I like to talk to my feelings like they're people. So I personify them. So if I'm having a day where I'm really sad, I will personify them. Like the movies Inside Out, if you've seen that, they're real. I'll picture them. My anxiety is like this little gremlin with fiery hair, and I'll personify them, and they'll talk to me. I will speak to them. Okay, what are you telling me? And they'll talk back. When you can personify them, they become a little separated from you. And it gives you enough space to recognize they can be separate and also have meaning and give you information that you can change how much you want to engage with that. And then you can also say, thank you, I'm done with you. It gives you to sort of choose how much you engage. And the third thing is that we as people, but as a society, really do have work to do on increasing our distress tolerance. We have just leaned into quick dopamine hits. We have leaned into fast media, quick gratification, and we are losing tolerance for low stimulus, for slow moments, and for discomfort. So I would challenge everyone to try something like the ice cube challenge. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's one of my favorite techniques, just to try every once in a while. Put an ice cube in your hand, hold it as long as you can. It's not comfortable, but it will not kill you. And see if you can go and tolerate how much you don't like it. And let it hurt. Let it be what it is. And maybe you don't get through it until it fully melts.
Right.
I mean, we can see if you can get a little bit further. Work on tolerating discomfort. We can handle a lot more than we think we can.
That's so true. Now, what actually creates lasting change for people?
Okay, there's a phrase in neuropsychology, what fires together, wires together. So when you think of axons and dendrites and the pathways that, you know, our neurotransmitters are firing, the things we do over and over create literal paths in our brain. So to make lasting change, you have to do something else over and over and over and over and over. That's why these quick fixes aren't quick fixes, because they don't habitualize. It has to be consistent. It has to be. And that's why it's important to start with small things like tracking patterns or holding an ice cube, because you can't just turn anxiety off. You have to take tiny, tiny steps and incorporate them into slow shifts so that over time they can expand into habitual shifts into, wow, I'm just starting to tolerate things a little better. I'm learning to live with more discomfort.
I love that. Now, let's talk about relationships. How does anxiety show up in relationships?
How much time do you have? So many ways. But the classical anxious attachment, if we're going to talk about sort of attachment theory, there is sort of a way of being built that can appear, you know, that we kind of call the anxious attachment, that is more characterized by oh, what can look like a neediness of reassurance. So a partner might need space. The other, the more anxiously wired one might be, you know, really pulling for reassurance. Please come back. I need to know. Text me. I need to know. Difficulty sitting with that distance, needing the continual reassurance of presence. So again, the difficulty with the ambiguity, the difficulty with discomfort, it plays out with the relationship. So trusting that things are okay without continual reassurance tends to be a big challenge.
Why do you think people overthink, they seek reassurance, or they feel emotionally drained, you know, when it comes to relationships?
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to quantify that because you could have 10 people who present the same thing. I'm drained, I'm overthinking, but the reason behind that would be completely different. So it's hard to, sometimes it's a lack of a development of a sturdy sense of self. If sense of self isn't really cleanly developed, there is a tendency to need to rely on external validation to then feel solid. I don't really know who I am, so I need you to tell me who I am. So that's a common one. But the next person over, it could be something like truly a chemical imbalance of sorts where there is just an overdrive of something that needs to be, you know, worked on. I am so not against, you know, medication. I want to make sure that's clear too. Like, I do think we can heal ourselves. It has its place. And then we've got trauma. You know, trauma rewires everything. We've got an event. We've got events that can shift everything. You can have a securely attached person who witnesses or goes through an event, or we now understand can go through chronic events that change everything about how you relate to people. To where you don't trust the world anymore. You don't trust yourself anymore. So you don't trust your brain anymore.
Right. That's so true. How can someone recognize this pattern themselves? Because, you know, a lot of times we don't recognize now unhealthy patterns that we do, whether it's denial or it's just because we're so used to doing it that it's become natural in our behavior, even though it's not really something that you know, is a good thing. We tend to sometimes not recognize it. So how can someone, you know, recognize that, you know, unhealthy pattern in themselves?
I love that. I mean, if someone's ready to do that, that's the first thing. Many people never reach the point of being ready to really look at themselves. If one is ready, it is amazing what can happen if you just ask yourself that question and you're honestly ready to hear the answer. If you open that space up and really ask, sometimes it really does reveal itself. You know, things will come forward if you clear the space. But other things work too. If there's a trusted friend or companion, if you're ready to hear the truth, ask. Ask for a few. Hey, I'm ready to learn about myself. Do you notice things? What do you think I might want to work on? If you were to give me goals, you know, feedback from people who know you, but who you trust. Of course, if you're into it and can have the space for it, some kind of tracking, journaling. I'm not one, it's too much to stay consistent, but even if it's just a couple of words a day of just where you're at mentally, over time, you extrapolate patterns and you kind of, and sometimes that can be revealing.
That's so true. Now, here's something that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. We have to move, you know, we have more tools, more awareness, more access than ever before. So why do people feel worse in our society instead of better?
Yeah. Well, I think some would say short form media. It's a lot of, there's a lot of, so much has changed in such quick time. The exponential shift just from when I was a kid until now, it's a different world. I don't think we know the impacts. And when you think of, you know, when you pull out, zoom out, and you think of just the last, I don't know how many years, when you put together the political climate, going through a pandemic and going through just the acceleration of technology, I feel like I can say I know our nervous systems were not built to accelerate at this kind of speed and to metabolize this much information. We do evolve. Of course, we do evolve, but we weren't built to evolve and metabolize as quickly. It's been so much at once. And now that any piece of information is available at any moment. We are inundated with stimulus. And historically, it was more moderated. So our nervous system could a little better catch up to what was in front of us. But it's light speed. And I think that we are paying the price in terms of our arousal levels as a society.
Well, I can't agree more with you, 100%. Now, let's bring this back to the listener. And if someone is feeling stuck right now, what is one shift that they can make to start understanding themselves better?
Yes, I really like that. My favorite and best thought here is to try, and this sounds so easy, but it's really hard. And I want to validate, this is really hard, but to try to get curious instead of judgmental at every thought and every feeling. Okay. We don't have control over our feelings and we don't control our thoughts. They're not bad. They're not good. They're there. We judge them so hard. So if you can try just for an experiment, look at them curiously and just observe. Just observe them. Like, huh. And try to suspend the judgment and practice that. If that starts becoming more natural, the next step is to then try to talk and listen like your voice, your internal voice, and your feelings are your friend. So from neutrality to compassion.
I love that. Now, what's one thing they should stop doing immediately?
That one's going to challenge me. I don't typically like to use stop language. Okay, I'm going to put it this way. I'm going to turn it into a positive.
Okay.
You know, when we talk about self-care, we kind of talk about it like, get a massage, take a bubble bath, take a walk. Those are real things. And this is what I want to encourage people to do. Think about how you would take care of somebody in your charge, right? In your charge. You would make sure they ate. You would make sure they were taking, you know, their hygiene seriously. You would talk to them kindly. You wouldn't swear at them. You wouldn't critique them. You wouldn't put them down. So those are the things. If you find yourself in the self-talk, that is what you stop immediately.
I like that. I like that a lot. Now, if someone is listening and feels like I've tried everything and nothing is working, what would you say to them?
Well, you could try my book.
I love it. I love it.
You know, the therapist is anxious too, which I will talk about in a moment. I think therapy, honestly, like really, but I'd say that with a caveat. It is not one size fits all. It's a huge range out there. And if anyone, you know, people who have tried therapy know that you might call 10 therapists, you might get no calls, no return calls. You might see 5 therapists and 4 of them are, I've heard horror stories, but my plea to you is, you know, 2 things. Don't give up and trust yourself, trust your gut. If you don't feel right, it's not right. You are the expert on your life and you deserve someone who makes you feel seen and heard immediately, who is ethical and respectful, who treats you like the expert on your life, and where you feel like it's right every single time. So seek it out. Do the brave thing. Don't give up on yourself. It is an investment in yourself. And there are people, my practice included, that devote their lives to walking this journey in helping regulate nervous systems and helping heal all of us. Because it's mutual. I get something from this work too.
I love that. Now tell me more about your book, because your book looks beautiful. The cover looks beautiful. I'd love to learn more about it. Can you tell us a little about your book?
I mentioned in college losing one of my dear friends to suicide. He sparked this because he sort of sparked my journey into psychology to understand him better. So in 2020, during COVID, I wanted to do something to honor him. And also, my sister, being a Broadway actress, was out of work, and she's also a painter. So we collaborated where she did watercolors, and I wrote this book on how to manage anxiety from an existential perspective of embracing it and understanding it rather than just pushing it away. We wrote this book, Your Therapist is Anxious Too. So this is my sister, and she painted her brain full of anxiety. And so in just beautiful full circle, my friend Kevin, who took his life, his father, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, incredible man. Ron Powers edited the book. So it's very special. But each chapter talks about one prong of anxiety. So this is what we resist persists. talking about harder we push back against anxiety, it's going to push back harder. And each chapter comes with a watercolor that you can also.
Wow.
And it represents that chapter. And so the chapter comes with information on that item, and then it comes with an exercise that you engage with to practice. So it's to expand our tolerance and to understand how our anxiety functions, but also to respect it. So this was a labor of love and something that was very meaningful to me. So
that's wonderful. Now tell us a little about the services that you provide.
Yes. So like you mentioned, I'm the founder of Gemstone Wellness, the owner, and my co-owner, Andrea Santiago, she is my partner in all things there too. So we run this business and it's in Chicago, and we offer individual therapy, couples counseling. Andrea offers immigration assessments, and we offer sex therapy. And every therapist in the practice is trauma-informed and works with clients where they are from a trauma-informed lens. And we all work very well with anxiety, nervous system regulation, and helping people find their way back to the mind-body connection.
I love that. I love that. And where can people find you? What's your website?
GemstoneWellness.com. And same on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn. For those who are interested, we have a resources page where I created a free downloadable nervous system assessment where you can download a form where you can take an assessment to see your specific arousal levels for your nervous system. So that's another thing when for someone who might not know exactly where they're carrying stress, that's one way to just see where you might be holding on to some nerves that you're not even aware of.
Wow, that's amazing. And a lot of times people aren't aware of some of the emotions because 90% of our emotions are stored in our subconscious. I highly suggest that if someone wants to really figure out, like, you know, where they're at in life to do that assessment, I think it's really, you know, something that will be very beneficial to anybody, actually. I am so glad, Jenny, that you came on the show today. I think that so many people today go through, you know, different emotions. They go through anxiety. They go through overwhelm. They go through, you know, having panic attacks related to anxiety. Some people resort to suicide because they don't feel a way out and they don't know what to do, or they don't want to, you know, share it with anybody because they don't want to be judged. So it's so important that we have outlets like yourself, you know, to go to people that could actually help us, hold our hand, take us step by step, because it's okay to feel these ways, you know. Yes. It's okay to have these emotions. It's okay, you know, our thoughts are never wrong. And, you know, people have to realize that. And it doesn't make us less of a person, you know, to be going through certain things in life emotionally, mentally. You know, we're stronger by reaching out and asking for support. So I really admire everything that you do. And if you wanted to, before we end this, what is like one or two things that you would like the people listening to this episode to remember, that, you know, something important that you feel that you would want them to walk away with?
You know, that your body knows how to heal. That your body knows what to do, that you are strong and empowered. You have the tools. You are the expert, and you can trust yourself. And anytime you feel like that is untrue, there's debris in the way to remove, and you are the problem. And I would like to just throw in the caveat that, of course, there are clinical times when anxiety and these, you know, disorders reach a point where what I'm saying does not apply. There are, you know, times where they're much more serious. And I'm not talking about serious mental illness today. I'm talking about the everyday levels of anxiety that many of us face. But I do want to be clear about that. There are times where my tools do not apply, and this would be something much more serious we would be talking about. But for today's purposes, yes, that is what I would want to say.
I love that. And I just want the listeners to know that sometimes the problem isn't that you're broken, you know, that you've been trying to fix the wrong thing. And once you understand what's really happening underneath everything, it starts to make sense. So, you know, I think people really need to understand why they're feeling the way they do. And they need to go to somebody like yourself to learn what's the underlying. I really admire what you do once again. And I thank you so much for being on this show and sharing your input, because so many people, you know, go through anxiety and overwhelm, especially in our today's society. And I really admire you and admire what you do. And I love your unique approach. And I think you're wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacey.
You're very welcome. You have a great day.
You too.